Good afternoon, everyone. We will begin in about 30 seconds. All right, good afternoon, everyone. Nice to be here with everyone. We're trying to figure out when was the last time we were here, and I think it was July 4th weekend. So July 4th weekend. So it's been a little bit, been a crazy summer, but everything went well. We had all the camps, and now it feels like the camps were last year. So it feels like it's been a long time ago, but camps went extremely well, all of them. It's nice to be able to say that now they're behind us, but when they're in front of you, it is just like a big anxiety attack ready to happen all the time. So, but it went really well, so thank you to everyone for your prayers for that. A quick announcement before we get into this. I'll do a reminder at the end of the Bible study as well, that if you did bring snacks for in-between services, they have the Sabbath school room downstairs available for eating the snacks, so they have tables and that. So we want to put everybody down there that is going to eat snacks so that we don't have to mess with this room up here. So that is for between services and the Bible study. All right, let's go ahead and open with prayer. So if you bow your heads. Father in heaven, we come before you today again to say thank you for all that you have given us. You have blessed us so abundantly. We do see it. We recognize it. We also recognize we do not see all of your blessings, but we thank you for your love and your kindness. We thank you for your direction through life, but also for understanding of your word as we are on the path to grow and develop more and more as we can to become more like you. So, Father, we're asking that you'll guide and lead this Bible study, that you'll guide and lead my words and open our ears to be able to understand more of your word, knowing that you are the great God. You have a great plan, and there's much for us to grow in understanding. We love you so much, and we thank you. In Christ's name, we ask this prayer. Amen. All right. I would like to look to get started at the physical value of sheep. So the spiritual value of sheep, you can find the analogies throughout the Bible of what that is, but that's not what I'm wanting to do. I want to look at the physical value of sheep because it has a lot to do with the story that we're going to be getting into. It's going to be 1 Samuel 25 is what we're going to be looking at today, 25 and chapter 26. But references to sheep are found throughout the Bible. Sheep were often used as sacrificial animals. There was monetary value placed on that as well throughout the Old Testament. They were also a primary source of income, which becomes a very important part of the story that we will review today. They were a very important part of income in those cultures, very important parts of income for how they would live. So very important. God made these animals a very valuable source of food, of clothing, not too hard for us to grasp that. Although precious metals, land, crops were also a sign of wealth, you are looking at owning livestock was a very important sign of wealth, something we don't necessarily put to or relate to so much anymore in our regular lives, but it was very much at that time. It was mentioned at the beginning of the book of Job that he had 7,000 sheep, and he was mentioned as being very rich. So 7,000 sheep. Now, we know the story of Job, and by the end, while he lost all of that, by the end, he got twice as much. He had 14,000 sheep, just extremely rich, extremely wealthy. Picture of that time. If you remember the story of Abraham and Lot, that they had huge or very large flocks of sheep, and if you remember, they had led to a conflict between the two, and they had to split and find land that could serve both of them, but they were both considered wealthy at that time. The predators to sheep, when they were led out to grazing lands, was extremely long. It was a long thing. There were wolves, there were bears, there were lions that could do great damage to any kind of a flock, but the greatest danger to a flock were raiders. So raiders or surrounding peoples, probably, again, the greatest danger to the flocks, would steal from the flocks themselves. They would be able to take for their own, which would take a lot of wealth. So every time a sheep was lost, wealth was lost. every single time. One sheep, that is a monetary value taken from the owner. If you lost many sheep, a great amount of wealth was lost. So all of that, keeping that in mind, let's go ahead and pick it up in 1 Samuel 25. So as we're turning there, remember that in the previous chapter, David just spared Saul's life, and they momentarily reconciled. Now, it's not much of a reconciliation. Momentarily, Saul stopped pursuing David is what happened. David never fully trusted this, what would happen, but he stops pursuing David, and it's brief. And this is the story that comes up in between the times that Saul wants to kill David. Right after the whole moment, now something monumental happens. Let's go ahead and pick it up in chapter 25, verse 1. It says, "Then Samuel died, and the Israelites gathered together and lamented for him, and buried him at his home in Ramah. And David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran." So the death of Samuel, the last judge, if you remember, he was a prophet judge, the last of his kind. This is a monumental moment again for Israel. He just died. It's a big deal. And he was the one who anointed the first two kings. So the first two kings of Israel, he's the one that God used to anoint them. Keelan Dielich brings out that Samuel, who has been justly called the reformer and restorer of theocracy, he's the one that brought Israel back to what they should have been and should have been doing. He was a massive influential figure, especially at that time. Also something, and that's where we're going to leave that part of the story, something else to mention here is the wilderness of Paran. The wilderness of Paran is in the northern portion of the desert of Arabia. Just a little bit of geology there, or geography. There's a minor debate whether it's the wilderness of Paran or the wilderness of Maon. Now, for our purposes, it doesn't really matter. It does when you're looking at it, because the distances from things just don't really make a whole lot of sense. But the reason for that, either way, it's important to see that whichever it was, David's presence in the area was important to the story. Him being there is extremely important for chapter 25, for the story we're going to read. Plays a very big part into it. So about the wilderness of Paran, or I would say also the wilderness of Maon, Jameson Fawcett Brown says, "Stretching from the Sinai to the borders of Palestine and the southern territories of Judea, like other wildernesses, it presented large tracts of natural pasture, to which the people sent their cattle at the grazing season, but where they were liable to constant and heavy depredations from prowling Arabs," be able to take a lot of the flock. So again, that becomes a major theme to this story, people taking of the flock, taking of that wealth. So no matter where the exact location is, the service David provides that we will read about and see throughout the story is extremely valuable. It's not just a nice gesture. It's extremely valuable. So it's not something small. All right. Often, I have another note, there could often be great losses to the flocks, which was a direct connection to someone's wealth. So you could bleed somebody of wealth if you took their flock from them or large portions of that flock. Verse 2 says, "Now there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel, and the man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats." So his wealth, there was a lot of wealth there. And he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. So shearing the sheep is a little different than what it sounds like to us. Today, that's just a day of work. That's what I would picture. Shearing the sheep is something you get in there and it's a day of work, a couple days of work. It's hard work. But this was a big deal, especially for really large flocks. Shearing the sheep, when we're reading it, it goes well beyond just the name shearing the sheep. So Expositors adds this, adds a little detail. It says, "Sheep shearing, a time for celebration to place after the summer grazing when profits were distributed." TSK offers this as well. It says, "Appears to have been always attended with festivities." So shearing the sheep was a time of celebration. It was a big deal. There was things to do and a lot of eating, a lot of celebration because it was a whole year of hard work. So whenever we see that, it is actually a big deal for everyone that is involved. This particular year, which I'm spending a lot of time on the first two verses, I know. But this particular year would have been the potential for some of the greatest profits that Nabal would have had. It would have been the greatest year of returns. Could have been quite a bit more than other years. This man from Moan had 3,000 sheep, 1,000 goats. This was a lot of wealth for one man to have at that time. And you think about the wool, the meat, the milk, the hides, and on and on and on. There's a lot of money wrapped up into what he owns. So, side note, from the Cultural Background Study Bible, it mentions as early 2nd millennium BV, texts from the Babylonian city of Larsa indicate one sheep would produce over 2 pounds of wool at shearing time. Then Nabal's 3,000 sheep, of which we will get introduced to Nabal here in just a second, but then Nabal's 3,000 sheep would have produced over 3 tons of wool, 6,000 pounds, 3 tons of wool. That is a lot of money, just in wool itself, not the other things that they provide, and not the other things that the goats would have provided as well. What this verse is doing, when we're looking at, to anybody that was familiar with it at that time, would have known these things, it would have been something they pictured. I'm far removed from it. It wouldn't be until I studied it what I'm actually looking at here. But it's trying to build the picture of who is involved and really what is at stake. With great wealth could potentially come great loss, is what that's trying to picture. For instance, an owner of these sheep and goats would know that there is going to be a yearly loss. That is part of doing business. I know I'm going to send my flocks out, and I know there's going to be a loss. Maybe it's 10%. Every year, I know I'm going to lose 10%. Made that up. I have no idea. But 10% loss. And that is part of doing business, and you accept that. You account for that. You know there's going to be a loss. But here comes the question for the story. What if something was put in place that kept there from being any loss? That's a 10% would be a massive amount of wealth lost. Well, what would happen if something was put in place where there was zero loss? Every year you lose livestock, but this particular year you lose nothing. That would mean that you retain all of your wealth and lost none. What that means is you just became richer within what you had. It became more abundant. So that becomes an important theme throughout the story. Verse 3. The name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife Abigail, and she was a woman of good understanding and beautiful appearance, but the man was harsh and evil in his doings. He was of the household, or the house of Caleb. Now, we're going to introduce two of the main characters of the story. Now, you could say, well, David's the main character, and he is, but actually the two main characters are Nabal and Abigail. It's one of my favorite stories because I think she is just a phenomenal woman. I think she's a great character, just a very strong person. But you have Nabal and you have Abigail, and they're complete contrast to one another. They're not alike at all in anything that they do. Abigail is very strong. She's intelligent. She's a very beautiful woman. Nabal is harsh, and he is evil. That is his character. That's the type of person that he is. Verse 3 is what's built over the rest of the story. When you read verse 3, that's what we see the rest of the story develop from, is verse 3. What is said in verse 3 will come to life in the next verses. One more thing to mention here is the name Nabal. You know, we've made fun of it because it's kind of it is a funny name and the meaning of it. This is most likely not his birth name, but it's what his name became because of his actions. If you remember going back, or actually going to the New Testament, where Barnabas, his name was Yosef, that was his real name, but the apostles changed it to Barnabas, encourager, because that was a character that he held, and that was what he was known for the rest of the time. Very similar here, that Nabal, that was not going to be his birth name, that was what he became known for, because he was a scoundrel, as we'll see later. Keelan Dielich says this was hardly his proper name, but was a surname by which he was popularly designated on account of his folly. He was, well, I'll just say harsh and evil. He just was not a good person. But we don't know his real name. It never comes out. I've heard some theories. I've read some theories, and none of them, I think, are very good. So verse 4 says, when David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep, David sent 10 men, and that's at the time from person of influence to person of influence, 10 men. 10 men was something that you sent. It was appropriate to do that. And David said to the young men, go to Carmel, go to Nabal, and greet him in my name. My name means greet him from David. You represent me. Verse 6. And thus you shall say to him who lives in prosperity, Peace be to you, peace to your house, and peace to all that you have. Verse 7. Now I have heard that you have shears. Your shepherds were with us, and we did not hurt them, nor was there anything missing from them all the while they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please give whatever comes to your hand to your servants and to your son David. Very respectful thing. His approach was really good. Couple things here. David is saying, we have done you a great service, and whatever you could give us would be greatly appreciated. Now, we look at this and we say, you know, why did he do this? Because that seems weird. I'm going to do something. It's a favor. I'm going to do something, but now I'm going to ask for it. Well, we're going to see in just very soon, that it was kind of the way things were at that time, the unwritten law of the land. We'll see that in a bit. The second thing to see here is in the New King James, it says a feast day. This is not one of God's holy days. The King James Version has a good day. This is in reference to the festivities that are taking place. This is not one of God's holy days. This was a great feast, though, that was happening because there were celebrations around what was happening. Verse 9. So when David's young men came, they spoke to Nabal according to all the words that in the name of David, and waited. Then Nabal answered David's servants and said, who is David and who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants nowadays who break away each one from his master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shearers and give it to men when I do not know where they came from or where they are from? Verse 12. So David's young men turned on their heels and went back, and they came and told him all these words. So Nabal says, who is David and who is the son of Jesse? And we look at that and we say, okay, what does that mean? Is he just like, I don't know who that is. I've never heard of David. I don't know who the son of Jesse. I don't know who Jesse is. Who are we talking about? Is he confused on that? No, this was an extremely offensive thing to say. This was a smack in the face to David. This had nothing to do with, I don't know this person. This has everything to do with, I know this person and I don't recognize them as anything. So it was a smack in the face. It was more of, why would I concern myself with him? I don't acknowledge him as anything. What would I have to do with this person, David? He's not a servant of mine. I'm not going to work with him. I don't recognize him more than a scoundrel that he is. Well, flipping that over. Who is he but a vagrant and a servant? He is below me. I owe him nothing. Go ahead and leave. So it was a big slap in the face. Verse 13 says, then David said to his men, every man gird on his sword. So every man girded on his sword, and David also girded on his sword. And about 400 men went with David, and 200 stayed with the supplies. Verse 14, now one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, look, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, and he reviled them. So the words, and he reviled them, shows that our English translation, how we speak in English, doesn't quite reveal the meaning behind the words Nabal said to David. It was a very offensive thing. We look at it, we don't see it as much of an offense, but at that time it definitely was. This was very offensive. David's reaction, now don't get this wrong, David's reaction is over the top. It is wrong how he approaches this. But it shows that what took place wasn't small. It wasn't just a small offense. It was a big offense. Now, David's wrong in his approach, for sure. Verse 15. But the men were very good to us, the servant still speaking to Abigail, and we were not hurt, nor did we miss anything as long as we accompanied them when we were in the fields. Verse 16. They were a wall to us both by night and day. All the time we were with them keeping the sheep. So again, this is adding on the fact that nothing was lost. Nothing. A year like no other year, nothing was lost that we had. The herd stayed intact, the great wealth was kept, and David and his men protected the shepherds and the flock. This was something very, very big. Jameson Vossett Brown again adds something more to the story of what at different times actually took place. When we're looking at the story, why did David approach it this way? Why did he get so angry? He's ready to do a slaughter. So why would he do that? So again, James Foster Brown says, "The preparations of David to chastise his insolent language and ungrateful requital are exactly what would be done in the present day by Arab chiefs who protect the cattle of the large and wealthy sheep masters from the attacks of marauding border tribes or wild beasts. Their protection creates a claim for some kind of tribute. So I protect you, you will give me a tribute. It's the relationship that was built." He goes on to say, "In the shape of supplies or food or necessities, which is usually given with great good or will and gratitude." Why? Because you've protected my flock. I receive a whole lot more than I'm going to give you for your service, basically. They're very happy. It's this next sentence. "But when withheld," when that gratitude is withheld, "is enforced as a right. Nabal's refusal, therefore, was a violation of established usages of that place." Now, a lot of that, there's a lot of words there. I don't care for when people just read a bunch to me when I'm listening to a sermon. There was a lot there. But as often is the case when reading the Bible, we miss the context. Why would David act this way? He's ready for slaughter again for not receiving something that he did. We don't live in that time now. Things that were expected then are lost on us. But to them, it was how things were and expected to be on both the owner of the sheep and the one protecting. This was a relationship everybody knew about. Not just David and Nabal, but how the law of the land was. Verse 17, we'll see this more in just a minute. "Now therefore, know and consider what you will do, for harm is determined against our master and against all his household, for he is such a scoundrel," there's that word, "that one cannot speak to him." Verse 17 is very interesting to me. One thing that this shows is who does the servant go to? Does he go to his master? No, he doesn't go to his master. He goes to Abigail. She is the one that they look to. That is the strength of that family or that over the servants and all of that. Abigail has had consistent history with the workers that they were comfortable with approaching her. They don't approach Nabal. They're not going to open that door. They're not going to go to him. Another thing I find interesting is that the worker knew that it wasn't only the master who was in trouble, but so were all the household. Mainly the males. David's 10 men didn't say that. Why would he know we're all in trouble? All the males in our farm and all the servants and all of that, all of us are in trouble. Why would they know that? Because it was the unwritten law of the land. What would happen? So again, why do I find that interesting? Because it was a known way of doing things at that time. It was the way things were. It was it would have been the known way to treat David and his men by giving them provisions for the great protection they provided. But it was also known that if they didn't treat the chieftains at that time, the Arab chieftains, or David's men at that time honorably, who protected your flocks, then they would, as we read earlier, by right punish you and take what they wanted. So if you're not going to give them something, they can come in and take whatever they wanted and do whatever they wanted. Kind of the unwritten law of the land again. Not how God expected things to be, not how God would want things to be, but that is the law of the land. That was how things were. David, again, is not in the right, but Nabal is being very stupid. He's being very foolish in this. Verse 18, "Then Abigail made haste, took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 sheep already dressed, 5 seahs of roasted grain, 100 clusters of raisins, and 200 cakes of figs, and loaded them on donkeys." So I'm going to stop there just for a minute. I couldn't find anything specifically mentioning what I'm getting ready to say, but it was a friend. So I gave this Bible study already in Newark, and it was my friend, many of you know him, Rich Johnson, mentioned something to me that I didn't mention in the Bible study down in Newark, something that I studied few days this week trying to find something you can't. He said that it seems like a lot of food. You're looking at that and it seems like there's a lot of food there. And there's an abundance of food. I mean, they have 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine. It said 2 skins of wine, but it's even bigger than that. These skins were called bottles. If you have a King James Version, it has bottles. It was a goat skin that held lots of wine, gallons of wine we would see. You have 5 sheep already dressed. Seems like a lot of food. But when you realize we're talking about 600 men, then you also realize that this is essentially one meal. You're looking at one meal worth of food. You're not looking at very much food here. I would add that it wasn't 600 men. It wasn't 600 men at all. It was 600 men plus women and possibly children, and I would say there are children there. And that becomes more evident in chapter 30. We see that there are women with the 600 men. It is families that are there. So this amount of food wouldn't last long. It's one meal, maybe even a tiny meal. David, more or less, was asking to share a meal in the festivities, to be able to share a meal with Nabal for what they provided, but being linked in a partnership and a relationship during that time. So it's a big slap in the face saying, no, I don't see you as anything, go away. Verse 19, and she said to her servants, go on before me, see I am coming after you. But she did not tell her husband Nabal. Smart move. Verse 20, so it was as she rode on the donkey that she went down undercover on the hill. And there were David and his men coming down toward her, and she met them. She takes what is right to take in her control because she has people counting on her. Her husband was a foolish man, and so she puts this on her shoulders. She takes provisions that should have been given to begin with. Now she has to go before a small army. You think about this story, and we've talked about this in a sermon, but you think about this. She now goes before a small army to try to convince them to stop. A woman. Now, she might have some servants that are there with her, but she is alone on this to try to stop a small, very angry army. She put herself in her shoes and tried to imagine how intimidating this would be. You are completely powerless physically to protect your people, yet she stands before them. To me, that is remarkable. That's part of the reason I love this story, just her character. Is she afraid? I would say yes, she is afraid, but she doesn't stop. She still stands before this angry army of men that are ready for slaughter, but it shows the character of this woman, Abigail, and how strong she is. Now, what was she up against? We get to see that in the next verse, or next couple of verses. Verse 21. Now, this is the mindset that she's faced with. Verse 21. Now, David had said, surely in vain I have protected all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belongs to him, and he has repaid me evil for good. May God do so and more also to the enemies of David, if I leave one male of all who belong to him by morning light. That's the mindset. We are going to go in there, and we are going to do a great slaughter because I've been offended. He has repaid me evil for good, so now I will repay evil for evil. Anger often tries to justify wrong actions. I've been wronged. They're the people that wronged me. Now I get to return that wrong. It's a very wrong mindset. You know, I am right to take a wrong action because of the wrong someone else did to me, and that's never the correct answer. Barnes adds this. It says, the concluding phrase denotes the utter destruction of a family. So when you say, I'm going to wipe out all the males, servants, the males of the household, Nabal himself, all of that, you're wiping out a family. You might not touch any of the women, but you're wiping out that family. Why? Because you want that line to end. That was the mindset, very angry mindset. Abigail's incredible character changes all of that. So that's the mindset. She changes all of that. Her response to all of this is one of tremendous humility. Go to verse 23. Verse 23, I have marked as the start of Abigail's humility. So verse 23 says, now when Abigail saw David, she dismounted quickly, that's not small, from the donkey, fell on her face, not small, before David, and bowed down to the ground, not small. So I have, again, verses 23 and 24 marked as Abigail's humility. That's what her approach is. A couple things to notice here. Be very easy to read over. It says she dismounted quickly. In the culture of that time, and in some places still today in the Middle East, this would still be the respectful thing to do. Dismounting in the presence of someone in authority or superior is the highest form of respect. So there is that authority coming towards you, and she dismounts very quickly. She doesn't waste any time. So again, not only did she dismount, but she did it quickly. That was a show of honor. And this was a great show of respect towards the superior. The second thing is bowed down to the ground. She follows up the dismounting of the donkey to bow down to the ground. And this is the lowest form of bowing. This is the lowest form of going before somebody that is a superior, somebody in power, and you bow down to them. Just this act was speaking volumes. Her message to David was strong, and she hadn't said a word. That's who she is. She hasn't said a word yet, but she is speaking volumes of very wonderful things. Verse 24. So she fell at his feet and said, "On me, my Lord, on me, let this iniquity be." That's very, in a way, Christ-like. You think about Christ, you also think about Stephen, very similar words. "And please let your maidservant speak in your ears and hear the words of your maidservant." She let him know, you have been wronged. There's no doubt about it. I'm not arguing that you haven't been wronged. You have been wronged. You were treated badly for the good that you provided, and we see it. Then she says, "I will take the blame for that. Put it on me. To be able to stop this, I will take the blame for that." She's willing for the good to come from this, to take the blame for something she had nothing to do about, and nothing, she didn't even know about it until later. Again, she is a person of great character. And now, verse 25 through verse 31, we see her wisdom, her incredible wisdom. Verse 25 says, "Please let not my Lord regard this scoundrel Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your maidservant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. Now therefore, my Lord, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, since the Lord has held you back from coming to bloodshed." That was a little bit of a punch in the gut, but in a wise way of saying it. "And from avenging yourself with your own hand. Now then, let your enemies and those who seek harm for my Lord be as Nabal." Verse 27. "And now this present, which your maidservant has brought to my Lord, let it be given to the young men who follow my Lord." So I have verses 25 through 31 marked as Abigail's wisdom. That's an incredible answer that she gives. This is something David writes about often in the Psalms, and I believe it was a learning lesson that David had from his, as we will see and you already know, his future wife, Abigail. But he learned a lot from her, and we'll see his eyes are opened, and he writes a lot about it within the Psalms. Vengeance is God's. It's not his. Vengeance is God's. They're strong and humble words. And she said, "The Lord has held you back from coming to bloodshed and from avenging yourself." It's a future thing. She's saying, "I've stopped you from doing this." She's not commanding him or rebuking him, but softly places wisdom in his lap. She's actually presenting three arguments to him to consider. Right now, his eyes are open. I picture him as just in awe of this woman standing before him or bowing before him. One, the three arguments. One, God is holding you back from doing a great wrong by coming to bloodshed. You go any further and you're stepping around the roadblock that God placed in front of you. All of a sudden, it just stops him. Okay, so if I go around you, then I'm going around what God placed in front of me. She's saying, yes, there's a roadblock, and I'm that roadblock. You can't go around me. Two, God is the one who avenges, not you. And I have several scriptures here if you want them, for God is the one that reserves vengeance. And it's Leviticus 19:18, very early in God's word, Leviticus 19:18. Deuteronomy 32, verses 34 and 35, and also verse 43. Psalm 94, in verse 1, Romans 12, in verse 19, and Hebrews 10, and verse 30. So all of that God reserves. God is the one that owns vengeance. The third thing, the third argument, is the gifts of provisions is to the young men, she says. She says, not directly to David. She didn't give these provisions to him. She gave them to the young men that follow him. So what is she saying? She's saying, these men are following your lead. Your next action impacts those who follow you. That's a big hit to his chest. So these men are following me, and I'm going to lead them into something that would be very, very wrong. The weight she just gently placed on his shoulders are extremely heavy. She's very wise. Verse 28 says, "Please forgive the trespass of your maidservant, for the Lord will certainly make for my Lord an enduring house, because my Lord fights the battles of the Lord, and evil is not found in you throughout your days." She just placed more weight on his shoulders, just keeps piling it on. In other words, this is what she's saying in a nutshell. It says, "You fight the battles of God, and up to now you have not avenged yourself. You haven't taken upon yourself up until now. You are the good guy in your story and not the one who does evil." And now her next words place a reminder of who he is. I think it's very valuable. Verse 29, I like verse 29 very much. It says, "Yet a man has risen to pursue you and seek your life." She doesn't deny that. "But the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living with the Lord your God, and the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the pocket of a sling." She knows who David is, and she knows his fame from the death of Goliath. Everybody knows who he is. Nabal knew who he was. Everybody in the kingdom knew who he was. I picture at this moment David's pride being struck by Abigail's sling and stone. Yeah, I think he is absolutely in awe of her, again, from everything that she values here, her character of humility and wisdom. His pride comes crashing down to the ground. I believe she was reminding him that the eternal God, who was with him on the battlefield with Goliath, was also with him now. But you can step around that if you want. But just as a reminder, God is with you now. And as God took care of him then, God will take care of him now. You don't have to worry about it, David. Verse 30. "And it shall come to pass, when the Lord has done for my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you, and has appointed you ruler over Israel." She knows. She knows what's coming. Verse 31. "That this will be no grief to you. You're not going to remember it, nor offense of heart to my Lord, either that you have shed blood without cause, or that my Lord has avenged himself. But when the Lord has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your maidservant." I believe she presented a picture of his future that he needed to be reminded of. You are the future king. It's already been written. You are the future king. You've been anointed to that. Everybody knows that. That's why you get pursued by Saul. Saul pursues you because of that. That this is the moment of offense is small compared to what God has in store. Actually, when God fulfills what he has in store, this is going to be just a very, very small thing in the past. Right now, you think it's big, but it's very small. It will be very small. She's an outstanding servant of God. Her words were soft, but they landed as they needed to. What if we could do the same thing? What if our words could be soft, but we could have words of wisdom land as they needed to? She is standing before 400 men ready for slaughter, ready for war, and their angry leader. And she, with God, stops them from going one step further. She not only stops them from killing Nabal and the men, she stops them from committing evil. She stops them from sinning, of which would have made God very upset. I've said it before that this is a person that we want standing next to you in life. This is the type of person we want to be for everyone else, and that's also who we want to surround ourselves with. Moving forward, I've marked verses 32 through 35 as David is humbled. He is humbled. Verse 32 says, "Then David said to Abigail, 'Blessed is the Lord God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. And blessed is your advice, and blessed are you, because you have kept me this day from coming to bloodshed and from avenging myself with my own hand. For indeed, as the Lord God of Israel lives, who has kept me back from hurting you, unless you have had hurried and come to meet me, surely by morning light no males would have been left to Nabal.' So David received from her hand what she had brought him and said to her, 'Go up in peace to your house. See, I have heeded your voice and respected your person.'" Remarkable words. This is so great. David listened to Abigail. If he is a godly man, she didn't leave him anywhere else to go. If she could break through that anger, this was the only option that he had. I think he is pretty amazed by her again. I've already said that a few times, but I do think he just sits there in amazement. He has been humbled and actually praised God for sending her as an instrument of God. Her wisdom was sent. Again, she wasn't an evangelist. She wasn't a preacher. She wasn't a prophetess. She didn't hold any position in that regard, but an incredible tool of God. She stood strong. The last statement, he said, respected your person, is to say, I will grant your request. I've heard what you said, and I respect it. I mean, what you've given me is just a nugget of gold, and I appreciate it. He's saying, I will grant your request. I believe verse 35 shows that David was amazed and impressed by her. Expositors add this, that he has been impressed and influenced by her impassioned arguments is clear from his acknowledgement that I have heard your words. Literally, I have listened to your voice, an idiom that is often implies obedience. I will obey what you said because I recognize God's word in you. I think that is pretty amazing. I'm listening to what you said, he says. Verse 36 says, now Abigail went to Nabal, and there he was holding a feast in his house like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he felt very drunk. Therefore, she told him nothing, little or much, until morning light, because she could tell him all kinds of things. What is he going to remember? He's going to remember nothing. Verse 37. So it was in the morning when the wine had gone from him, Nabal and his wife told him these things, that his heart died within him, and he became like a stone. Verse 38. Then it happened after about 10 days that the Lord struck Nabal and he died. She couldn't tell him again right away because he was so drunk. He most likely wouldn't have remembered it anyway. So she waits until he can understand every word that she's going to tell him. There's a lot written about, not a lot written about what happened to Nabal, but the exact thing is very difficult to pinpoint. So his heart became stone, and there's a lot of theories out there. There's some that we can jump to. I think there's some good ones, but that's all they are. We have no idea. Some people say it was a stroke. Some people said it was a heart attack. He couldn't handle all of that because that's kind of what it looks like, but that's not exactly what it's saying. It's actually saying just whatever did happen, he ends up dying from it. So the thing that we do know is that Nabal didn't handle the news well at all. He didn't handle it. He didn't like it. After 10 days, he dies. Was it a stroke? Was it a full heart attack? Was it something else? We really don't know. But Nabal now was dead. Verse 39 says, so when David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, blessed be the Lord who has pleaded the cause of my reproach from the hand of Nabal and has kept his servant from evil. For the Lord has returned the wickedness of Nabal on his own head, and David sent and proposed to Abigail to take her as his wife. When the servants of David had come to Abigail at Carmel, they spoke to her, saying, David sent us to you to ask you to become his wife. Then she arose, bowed her face to the earth, and said, here is your maidservant, a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord. Another remarkable thing she says. She's not looking to become powerful, but to remain a humble servant. I just love her story. I love her character. Verse 42. So Abigail rose in haste and rode on a donkey attended by five of her maidens, and she followed the messengers of David and became his wife. David also took Ahinoam of Jezreel, and so both of them were his wives, but Saul had given Michal, his daughter, David's wife, to Palti, the son of Laish, who was from Galim. So this is where we end the story of Abigail. I think a few things I think that we can get from the story are, one, that we can be wronged. When looking at this, how do we apply it to our life? When we can be wronged, it is never right to return a wrong for a wrong. It is never, if so-and-so lied to me, it's fine for me to lie to her or him. It's never fine to return that same wrong or to wrong that other person. God is the one who avenges. This is the next thing. We don't. As hard as this might be to swallow sometimes, it is the perfect way of God. It is not us that gets to avenge. The third thing I think we can get from the story is we could even see in the story that if someone must correct someone else, the way to do it is with humility and wisdom. but to do it with love. Truly a great story. All right. So chapter 26, we will get through it. We're going to get through it very quickly. It is done mainly as all of 1 Samuel is done in story form. I don't believe we have to spend very much time within chapter 26 to be able to get through it. So chapter 26, verse 1 says, now the Ziphites, now the thing about the Ziphites, I will stop there for a second. The thing with the Ziphites were the last time that Samuel pursued David, it was the Ziphites that kind of stirred him to action. You know, I know where his strongholds are. I know where he is. And what does David do? Okay, he goes and pursues them. Now we have the Ziphites again from the house of Ziph, I think it is. It says, now the Ziphites came to Saul at Gibeah, saying, is David not hiding in the hills of Hilkah, opposite Jeshimon? Then Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph. Now, that's okay, that's where they're from. Having 3,000 chosen men of Israel with him to seek David in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul encamped in the hill of Hakilah, which is opposite of Jeshimon, I love all these names, by the road. But David stayed in the wilderness, and he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness. Verse 4. David therefore sent out spies and understood that Saul had indeed come. So David arose and came to the place where Saul had encamped. And David saw that the place where Saul lay. And Abner, the son of Ner, the commander of his army, that's the one that is over the army but also protects Saul, the commander of his army. Now Saul lay within the camp with the people encamped all around him. So this would have been a common formation as the men were all around him. The one over all of the men, the commander, in this case, the king. So the most important would be in the middle, surrounded by all his men. And really, on the outskirts, a lot of times, would be supplies. It would be different things, but it was a way to be able to protect the most important man. Another thing that we know that this is most likely in haste, that he didn't take time to take all the provisions he needs. They're just out underneath the stars where they are. They're not within their tents. Also, the spears in the ground by him was a symbol of his position. We will see that play out as a big part in the story. But that is a part of Saul's position. That spear shows that he is king. You know, in other places we have scepters and we have these different things that show authority and everything. His was the spear. That was his show that he was king. Verse 6 says, then David answered and said to Ahimelech the Hittite and Abishai the son of Zeruiah, brother of Joab, saying, who will go down with me to Saul in the camp? And Abishai said, I will go down with you. I love the stories of David's men, his 70 mighty men, the ones that they are loyal to him. They will follow him anywhere. We see those stories throughout Samuel. But they will go anywhere. They're very loyal and they'll do anything for him. Worth noting is that Abishai is one of David's nephews, so there is a family tie there as well. Joab is as well, and then there's another nephew too, that they serve David very well. Verse 7 says, so David and Abishai came to the people by night, and there Saul lay sleeping within the camp, with his spear stuck in the ground by his head, and Abner and the people lay all around him. Then Abishai said to David, God has delivered your enemy into your hand this day. Now, therefore, please let me strike him at once with the spear right to the earth, and I will not have to strike him a second time. I don't have to do it twice. I'll kill him the first time. This will be quick, and then we can be out of here. I'll do whatever you say, David. Verse 9, but David said to Abishai, do not destroy him. For who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? Quite the contrast versus the story we just finished with Abigail and all the details there. He's ready just to slaughter anybody. Now we have this mindset here that recognizes God's hand that anointed the king. He recognizes that he does not have the right to remove what God put in place. God put Saul in place. David does not have the right to remove that. And he sees that. David understands that Saul's reign is coming to an end. And he explains that in this next verse. He says, it's going to end. I already recognize it's going to end. I already recognize the king that Saul's reign will end with him and go no further, and I will be king. Verse 10. David said furthermore, as the Lord lives, the Lord shall strike him, one, or his day shall come to die of old age, too, or he shall go out to battle and perish. Basically, it will be taken care of, but not by us. We're not going to do it. God already has this plan in place, that he will die of some way, and it will come to an end as all men die once. Verse 11, "The Lord forbid that I should stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed, but please take now the spear and the jug of water that are by his head, and let's go." So a couple things to note here. The spear is a symbol, again, of Saul's kingship. This is what he has with him all the time. It is suggested in one of the commentaries that the jug of water is a symbol of life. So you have the spear of his rulership, and you have the jug of water, which is a symbol of life. I'm not so sure I stand on the water being a symbol of life. I'm not jumping on that 100%. It sounds good, but I've never proven that, so it's hard for me to stand on that. But that is what was mentioned. So by removing both, he is making an extremely strong statement. He is making a very strong statement. Verse 12. Verse 12 says, "So David took the spear and the jug of water by Saul's head, and they got away, and no man saw or knew it or awoke, for they were all asleep because a deep sleep from the Lord had fallen on them. Now David went over to the other side and stood on the top of the hill afar off, a great distance being between them. And David called out to the people and to Abner, the son of Ner, saying, 'Do you not answer, Abner?' Then Abner answered and said," I kind of picture it as a startle awakening. "Who are you calling out to the king?" Verse 15, "So David said to Abner, 'Are you not a man? And who is like you in Israel?'" Not meaning who is like you, who holds your position? You have one job, or actually two. You're over the army, and you're to protect the king's life. Who's like you? There's nobody like you that has your position within the kingdom. He's kind of being a little bit smart here. It says, "Why then," verse 15, "why then have you not guarded your lord the king? For one of the people came in to destroy your lord the king. This thing that you have done is not good. As the Lord lives, you deserve to die, because you have not guarded your master, the Lord's anointed. And now see where the king's spear is and the jug of water that was by his head." Then Saul knew David's voice and said, "Is this the voice of my son David?" David said, "It is my voice, my lord, O king." And he said, "Why does my lord thus pursue his servant? For what have I done, or what evil is in my hand? Therefore, please let my lord the king hear the words of his servant. If the Lord has stirred you up against me, let him accept an offering. But if it is the children of men, may they be cursed before the Lord, for they have driven me out this day from sharing in the inheritance of the Lord, saying, 'Go serve other gods.'" Verse 20. "So now do not let my blood fall to the earth before the face of the Lord, for the king of Israel has come out to seek a flea, as when one hunts a partridge in the mountains." Then Saul said, "I have sinned. Return my son David, for I will harm you no more, because my life was precious in your eyes this day. Indeed, I have played the fool and erred exceedingly." And David answered and said, "Here's the king's spear. Let one of the young men come over and get it." He doesn't return the water, however. I take the spear was as taking the spear was a strong message, and we see that, taking that, what that represents. Equally a strong message is returning it, returning that spear. Again, David knows that Saul's reign will end with him, but he is still acknowledging that Saul is king until he dies. He does not fulfill that role until that moment. So he returned the spear. Verse 23, "May the Lord repay every man for his righteousness and his faithfulness, for the Lord delivered you into my hand today, but I will not stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. And indeed, as your life was valued much this day in my eyes, so let my life be valued much in the eyes of the Lord," not in your eyes, in God's eyes, "and let him deliver me out of all tribulation." In verse 25, let's go ahead and end this. We're coming to our time. Actually, we're past our time. "Then Saul said to David, 'May you be blessed, my son David. You shall both do great things and also still prevail.' So David went on his way, and Saul returned to his place." So I won't do the overall meaning. We'll go ahead and end there. I did go past my time. So next time, we may be able to cover more ground as next two chapters are a little bit shorter. That one I just read is basically story time in chapter 26. I just read that to you. So Mr. Henson will pick up the next Bible study beginning in chapter 27. I do want to remind everybody, if you do have snacks, again, the tables are set up downstairs. if you're eating that for between the Bible study and services. So, all right, thank you.